Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Understanding Literature and Life, Drama, Poetry, and Narrative, Part 3, Narrative. The speaker is Professor Arnold Weinstein of Brown University. Professor Weinstein received his undergraduate degree from Princeton University and his master's and doctoral degrees from Harvard University. He has taught at Brown University since 1968, where he has received great recognition for his teaching, including the Undergraduate Teaching Award in the Humanities. Professor Weinstein also serves as the chairperson of the Advisory Council on Comparative Literature at Princeton University. Lesson 41, The Lives of the Word, Reading Today.
I'd like in this lecture to do a number of things. To introduce the narrative segment of the course, therefore to say some things about both the nature, the value of narrative literature, but also to focus on a rather particular topic, which I'm calling The Lives of the Word, Reading Today. And you heard the plural there, The Lives of the Word, Reading Today. So I'm going to try to put all of that together. Let me start with narrative, because that's the large chunk of this course that's still going to come. This, of course, doesn't pertain to you in this room, but there are people who think of books as small propositions. That I think it's often felt that one reads books as a kind of alternative to experiencing life, that there's reality out there and then there are books over here. And that the notion of books as being small can be also backed up by the rather persuasive view that they are biased because they have the subjectivity of a particular writer who may be dead now for several centuries, and that they have a kind of inescapable limitation which you can't help but see when you see something that's that size and it's supposed to tell you about existence. I want in these remarks, obviously, to try to reverse that view, to counter it, and to argue the scope of narrative, because I think it is an extremely capacious form. It's a form that has a greater reach, probably, than either poetry or drama. And I'd like to define that scope, that reach, in two fairly simple ways, horizontal and vertical. And it sounds like I'm talking about geometry or talking about material objects, but I think you will follow me as I try to make these horizontal and vertical arguments. How would you talk about narrative horizontally? How would you say that it moves sideways or laterally? And what I'd like to suggest is that narrative functions in some odd way as an ecosystem, that it contains many things within it, that every story, even the stories that seem most claustrophobic, that seem to consist of a single speaking voice, are in fact stories that contextualize that voice, that show us the human individual within a situation, within a framework. There is always, always a panoramic global view within a story. And what I'm trying to say is that we as readers invariably see more than the characters within the text see, even though we are learning from them. They're telling us about their lives, and that's what we're reading. We have the panoptic overview. What I want to add here is something you all know, which is we never have it in life. We never have the panoptic overview, unless we happen to be God sitting on a cloud looking at the universe. But for the most part, we can only have the private, eclipsed view that comes with being who we are and not being anybody else. And so we are privileged or entitled to a larger purview of things when we read a novel. And I think it's important to remember that when you read. It's important to see that no matter how persuasive the voice of a character might be, There is more to the fiction than just that voice. There is a context. There is an environment. There is, if you were to use Henry James' term, a figure in the carpet, a pattern that gradually emerges, of which the speaker and the plot are only parts. And in that light, I can point, in some sense, to the text that we're going to look at and give you some hints about them. But as I say, I think this is a general kind of rule of thumb when you read narrative. Obviously, one wants to be swept away and very much involved in the speakers of the text. That is part of the thrill of reading novels. But at the same time, one wants to be able to see the larger picture. And as I say, one reason there is not to be, I'm not talking about being fooled by the text. I'm saying it's that grasp of the larger picture that is so special to literature and so unachievable in most of our experiences. For example, the first narrative text that we read in this sequence is the medieval romance, Yvain. But in fact, the full title of that is Yvain, or the Knight with the Lion, or the Knight of the Lion. And we are supposed to realize that the lion and the knight, in some strange sense, have a kind of dual identity, that these pieces in this strange story of a knight who loses his mind, changes his name from Yvain to the Knight of the Lion, then we have the lion that accompanies him, that somehow this forms a composite story, that the relationship between them, or the notion of an identity that is more than one's name, but that is somehow plural, that's what we are essentially challenged to see in that text. And I think one could make this argument for virtually every text that we're going to look at here, that there are pieces in the text that it's our job to see their fit. We think, for example, of the classic novel of the 19th century, Great Expectations, and we watch Pip make mistake after mistake after mistake in his grasp of his world, what he thinks of Miss Havisham, what he thinks of Estella. We see that that text is set within a very mysterious London, filled with all kinds of enigmas and riddles, with people doing strange things that no one understands. We alone have the fuller view there. It is true there'll be secrets in the text that the text will finally tell us, and we couldn't guess them. Nonetheless, our position is that larger view where we can see, in a sense, correctively, we can see more fully. Likewise, the great challenge in the novel by Bronte, Jane Eyre, is for us to begin to ponder the possible connection between little Jane and big Bertha Mason. There's a sense there that these two figures, and I will be arguing that in my analysis of this text, that these two figures appear to us to be separate, appear to the people within the text to be separate, but that in fact much of the excitement of that text comes in sensing how much they are figures of each other, that they are related to each other, that there's a kind of pattern that emerges there. And in fact, as I say, this is the kind of formula for much that happens in literature, that the tale of Melville's Bartleby seems to be about this strange creature, Bartleby, and yet we cannot help but see that it's about the speaker, the lawyer who narrates the story, and that fundamentally it's about that amazing fit between these two, which is a problematic fit, a puzzling fit, but it is what the story is about. These are all figural dramas. They become even more extreme when you get to Kafka, where you have stories, for example, such as In the Penal Colony, where everything, I think, has to do with the relation between these figures. Not the figures individually, but the relation between them, between the officer and the explorer, and ultimately between the prisoner and the officer. In the text as well, such as Faulkner's The Bear, we're going to see the same sense, the same challenge of widening our view, of realizing that the hunt, which is the central motif of that text, is a hunt that has many different dimensions. It's a hunt for bears, but it's also a hunt in the terms of a racial pursuit, and it is even a hunt in the sense of tracking our own history. So, in that light, narrative always makes us ponder the fit, makes us ponder the collective, ponder the larger global perspective. And I'd like to close that by reading you a piece from the author Carlyle. And it's, I think one of the most potent passages that I know, because the underside of everything that I've said here, which I haven't really stressed, is that this horizontal vision, this collective vision, this ecosystem picture of the world, essentially calls the bluff on our own notion of individualism. It just says that the individual is never an integral figure. The individual is never a fully autonomous figure. Whether or not the individual knows it, he or she is always connected, linked, somehow positioned within a larger field. That is true in science, and that is true in life. And I want you to think about that when we read, when I read you this passage. A poor Irish widow, her husband having died in one of the lanes of Edinburgh, went forth with her three children, bare of all resource, to solicit help from the charitable establishments of that city. At this charitable establishment, and then at that, she was refused, referred from one to the other, helped by none, till she had exhausted them all, till her strength and heart failed her. She sank down in typhus fever, died, and infected her lane with fever, so that 17 other persons died of fever there in consequence. The humane physician asked thereupon, would it not have been economy to help this poor widow? She took typhus fever and killed 17 of you. Very curious. The forlorn Irish widow applies to her fellow creatures as if saying, behold, I am sinking, bare of help. You must help me. I am your sister, bone of your bone. One God made us. You must help me. They answer, no, impossible. Thou art no sister of ours. But she proves her sisterhood. Her typhus fever kills them. They actually were her brothers, though denying it. What I'm trying to argue in that passage there is that we are not talking here about cold-heartedness and evil. That's one way to read it, but that's not the way that's interesting. We're talking about a failure of vision. I am me, you are you. You weren't my sister, you were not my brother. That is the logical view of the world where we are all living in single bodies that appear to have an end, a contour, it stops. There's a distance between all of us. Narrative says that distance is illusory, that we breathe in other people's breath in some sense, we catch diseases from other people, which is the case here, but we also catch their language, we catch their ideas. Certainly I wouldn't be talking to you if I didn't think that was possible, that I could infect you with my ideas. That's what art is always about. It's a sharing. There are entries here. Things enter into us, although we can't see it. You couldn't possibly photograph it. The narrative, larger collective view is always a view of this kind of traffic, this kind of interaction, the sense in which the individual is found to be porous, interable, changeable, and very often without suspecting it. And of course, again, I think that's true of the way we live. So that's the first argument I want to make, is that narrative enables us to see, at least in its stories, in every one of the stories that we're going to be looking at in this course, something of the way the individual is both positioned on a larger stage, but also conditioned by it, altered by it, turns out to be, once again, a player within a larger ecosystem, and therefore no longer possessed of the kind of authority and autonomy that most individuals think they have. Now I want to talk about the vertical side of it. The narrative doesn't just give us this broader, wider picture, a kind of spatial picture. It gives us a vertical picture, by which I mean a temporal picture. It extends our view of things over time as well as over space. The single, basic, wonderful plot of all narrative is to tell the life story, to capture a life in time, to capture the curve of a life. That is the plenitude of existence. And so the text that we're going to read, the story of Yvain, the story of Pablos, the story of Moll Flanders, the story of Jane Eyre, the story of Pip, the story of Ike McCaslin, the story of Seeley, all of those are stories that are narrated over time. They all show us something of the trajectory of a human life. And once again, I come back to my basic starting point. You cannot see that in your own life. It is true you can look at scrapbooks and you can look at photographs of when you were younger, and you can read records of what you said and thought, and you can see the data that's out there, but you cannot see the passing of time. It takes time for us to see these things. That is to say, we can think back on what we were like many, many years ago, but we can hardly grasp it all as a kind of flowing shape. Narrative makes that possible. In a small affair of 200 pages, you actually have the, at least the illusion, of seeing the curve of an entire life. There is something miraculous about that. As I say, it's denied to us in our own life. It's miraculous, and of course it's fictive. It's fictive in this sense. Not only has the author constructed it and made it for us, crafted it, but it's probably fictive even when we do it for ourselves. When we go back and remember our past, we are not reliving our past. It's gone. We are somehow reaccessing it, and we are putting it into a framework. We are saying that it is part of this larger shape. That's a hard thing to do in the sense that we have to work at that to see it right. And I want to suggest as well, it's a very gratifying thing to do. That the curve of Pip's life, for example, the clarity of his education, that pleases us. It gives us a sense of life having shape, life having a meaning, even where he makes mistakes. He, at the end of Dickens' novel, he then sees clear, and this gratifies, and not just for moral reasons, but for epistemological reasons, that it means that we finally have some light on how we have lived. Storytelling always performs this service for us. It posits a beginning, it posits a middle, and it posits an end. And almost all the stories that we read do this. It shows us the formation of a character, it shows us the adventures or trials or mistakes or whatever, and at the end, it shows us some kind of maturity, even if that maturity coincides with death. When we live, we have a lot more trouble knowing exactly what is a beginning and what is a middle and what is an ending. None of us here has chosen our birth. We are in the middle for our entire lives, and few of us will choose our ending. But narrative has the kind of aching cleanse, sort of clarity and sort of cleanness to it as it puts this structure onto life. How would you know at what point to say, this is when my life began? This is when this aspect of my career began. You look back and it's all a sort of unbroken continuum. That's the way we live, but art performs this service, as I said, of taking the bric-a-brac of experience and giving it a pattern, of taking all kinds of events and positing a kind of logic between them, a kind of connection, a kind of linkage between them. That's what storytelling is about. It's the creating of pattern. Now, I said it's fictive, this story. It's fictive in several ways. It's fictive because somebody wrote it for us. But it's fictive also for the very simple, somewhat tragic reason that we cannot retrieve our life out of the past. The best we can do is tell stories. And I'm not talking about stories about other people, but about our own. That we write, all authors write, both in time and against time. It's the condition of writing. You write in time because there's no way on earth to be freed of it. The writer is one day older after each day of writing. The writer is subject to the same kind of mortal scheme that all of us are. But the writer writes against time because of the very nature of the story that I'm talking about. That storytelling preserves lives. Storytelling gives that shape. Storytelling manages to start from beginning and go to end, all within several hundred pages, sometimes within 50 or 60 pages. Storytelling is the salvaging of a life. It constructs it in the shape of a kind of harmonious sequence of events. And as I said, we cannot go back in our own lives. We can return through memory, but we cannot get back the past. The only way we can get it back is through telling stories. That's the only way we could even see the past, is to somehow, every time you even think back of the past, you are probably telling a story. It's a question, as Adrian Rich would say, of descending into the wreck. Even a good life is a wreck in that sense, because things are over. Descending into the wreck and trying to come back with the treasure. There's a very well-known thesis that was talked much more about a decade or so ago than today by McLuhan about the media. I'm sure you're familiar with it, which fundamentally goes like this, that the media are there as a kind of extension of our neurological equipment. They extend the brain power of the human being, so telephone, radios, but also automobiles, planes, faxes, email. All of this extends our reach. It puts us in places beyond where we could be physically. It extends our whereabouts in space. It extends our presence, and it extends our power. What I have just been arguing is that narrative does that too, that language does that, that language performs that role. It translates us to ourselves. It makes our own large past somehow recuperable verbally to us. And of course, it translates us, delivers us to others as well. It expresses what is on the inside of us that others cannot see. And by doing that, it makes those things real for others. It constitutes our reach and our impact on the world. So that when we read texts, and above all, when we read texts of the past, we ourselves are invited to go into the minds of people long dead, to extend our own reach temporally. And this is where reading is very different, I think, from other media. And this is where I'm beginning to move into the issue of the lives of the word. Reading differs from other media, and we certainly know it today when we look at what the young do with Nintendo and with video, with music, with film. These are the hot media of our time. Those are immediately gratifying. They give images that require very little processing. They go directly to the brains of those who watch them or who hear them. No book has ever done that. A book is an arrangement of letters on a white sheet. And what the book always has required is a kind of humanistic labor. We have to translate those cryptic signs into meaning. It's one reason that reading is arduous in ways that watching video is not. That we have to extend our imagination, our capacity, to visualize this print. We have to turn it into image, turn it into story, turn it into meaning. Print that may be thousands of years old in some cases. As Melville will say, we have to take dead letters and make them living. I called it a humanistic labor because when you do it, when you open the text of the past and take that script and turn it into experience, the past stops being dead. That you effectively complete a communicative chain, that the vital news of human culture continues to be delivered, that the successive generations continue to be linked, that the store of experiences that have preceded us, which is enormous, that store, becomes magically available to us. So I said we write in time, and we write against time. We write because we're mortal. We write because writing somehow magically seems to give us the possession of our lives or the possession of other lives. And that has been called by one critic, narrative is the discourse of mortality. But the point that I have also made just now, that by reading we open up the past, we enter into the past stops being past and lives into the future, I want then to say that narrative is also the immortality of discourse, that narrative makes language live forever, at least insofar as people read. Words cannot die. They are not possessed of flesh and blood, and so they live. And if nothing else, that's what this whole program should make spectacularly clear, the lives of the word. And once again, in contrast with those of us in flesh and blood, once we're gone, the words that we uttered, stop being heard. But the words that we have written and the words that authors in great literature contain, those words go around and around. They lie low sometimes for centuries, then they are rediscovered, and they live anew each time some reader annexes them. So literary texts are fertile and potent, and they are capable of spawning other kinds of texts. They make guest appearances sometimes in the strangest places, and we'll see that, have seen it in this course. The Oedipus, for example, is all over the literature of the West. That its story of identity as a riddle informs in a different way Shakespeare's Othello and Strindberg's The Father. We saw that. But it is also evident, will be evident, in the narratives that we will look at, in the whole project of self-fashioning that one will see in so many of these texts, of Chrétien de Troyes, of Quevedo, of Defoe, Bronte, Faulkner, Walker. Likewise, motifs that are stolen from texts, for example, the motif of disguise that is so central in Othello, Iago, I am not who I am. It obviously is a central feature of theater, theater with its mask, theater with its roles as the indigenous structure of theater. That turns out also to be a potent strategy for narrative. So once again, we'll see disguise in Quevedo, in Defoe, in Bronte. It becomes a strategy for crossing class lines. And we'll see it even in a different way in the metaphysical tales of Kafka and in the lives of Alice Walker's characters. Much of the pleasure in reading literature consists in seeing these patterns of kinship, these family patterns. Texts have many lives. They have lives beyond the authorial intentions of the authors. Adrienne Rich, in her poem, talks about verbal privilege, and she talks about it as a kind of threat that the author cannot control the fate of his or her own text. And in terms of one's own powers of governance, it is a threat. If you would like to regard what you have written as something that has the meaning that you wanted it to have, then it can be understandably disturbing that others misinterpret it or that it gets misused by other people. And yet there's something glorious in that. It's a way of saying, once again, that the life of the word has a kind of power that nothing can coerce or govern, including the author who wrote it. It lives over time. And that's one reason that I have a bone to pick with historical interpretation. Much of it says, we're going to read this text and we're going to find out exactly what this author meant at that moment. What it is that Shakespeare meant with Othello. What it is that Dickens meant with Great Expectations. First of all, I have my doubts about how easily we could understand that or discover that, since neither Dickens nor Shakespeare is here to tell us that. Secondly, I'm not sure that Dickens and Shakespeare knew exactly what they wanted to tell us when they wrote those texts. But thirdly, I know we can't get back there and figure it out. That's a long way away. I'm not even sure I know what I mean when I speak, but to try to figure out what these people meant that long ago. But fourthly, and most interestingly for me, it's not so important what they meant. It is important, but not so important. It's not the only important thing. It's equally important what they mean to us and not what they meant then. This is heresy in the academy to speak this way. But nonetheless, it's an important point to bear in mind. When we read a book, first of all, we inescapably come from the present. You can read a medieval text, you can read a text from the Renaissance, but you are reading it now, which means you're bringing to it everything that forms you now. And that is true for historicist critics, and it's true for very everyday readers. But secondly, that's wonderful. You want to read books from the past now, because that is what increases our sense of the past and of now. That is to say, you want always to be able to take this material from far away and long ago and to see how it possibly spotlights, illuminates, alters, and challenges your own life now, your own situation. That is why reading is not a kind of antiquarian experience. When I say reading today, I mean all of these things. The fate of reading today, that is to say, reading as an endangered species, reading as threatened not just by video and by music and by film, reading perhaps even more profoundly threatened by the computer, with its electronic forms of retrieval and storage, its electronic forms of information giving, versus the labor, the humanistic labor that I described, that has to go into effect when we open a text and read it and see the language there. In this program, most of the people hearing this are not going to be reading it. They will be seeing it on a screen or listening to it on a tape. That is not the same as reading the books that are the subject of this program. Likewise, reading today has to do with reading our moment, understanding our moment. There are no cliff notes for today. We can read the papers, okay, and they'll tell us a few things, but in fact, our moment is in the murk. We are in it, in the midst of it. We don't have lights. We don't have criticism. And it is important for us to try to bring to this moment all of the ammunition, all of the equipment, all of the lights that we're capable of doing. And that's the reason that I say that reading the text of our moment, but above all, reading the text of the past, is not antiquarian. It is not because we have a love affair with the past, even though that's a fine thing. But that's not the reason. There's nothing escapist in it. It's not saying that, oh, I'm just interested in the 18th century. It's because the texts of the past are living. It's because the texts of the past invariably add to our own repertory. They show us possibilities of life, of experience. They show us choices made, mistakes made. They show us vistas. They show us sensibilities that must be different from our own. So reading the past allows us, in some sense, to acquire that store of imaginative possibility, of imaginative reality, and to bring it to today. It makes our encounter with today far more exciting and vital than it would otherwise be. Thank you.